this subject, and I just tell you, you know, I kind of have been drug into this, thinking about this for a number of years. I've been on the periphery of a discussion about Christian nationalism. I think at least going back to 2018, but it has really, of course, ramped up since 2020, and there's various reasons for that. It is a conversation that is kind of taking place nationally on several levels, meaning that when you hear people refer to Christian nationalism, you don't really know what they're talking about until you ask them a little bit more. Because people who are using the term are coming from all kinds of places on the perspective. Or another way to say that, if you just begin broadly with believers and unbelievers, if you hear an unbeliever use the word Christian national, they most likely mean simply Christian. In other words, to them, any Christian who believes that their faith should impact their life is a Christian nationalist. Or any Christian who believes in evangelizing other people or having any impact on the people around them is a Christian nationalist. So you're a Christian nationalist in the mind of the secularist, and most likely. I mean, if you hear them describe it at all, you would probably say, well, that's me. But whenever you get out of the secular world and into the Christian world, there are within the Christian world people writing on this and talking about this, and within the scope of those who would identify as Christian nationalists, there's differences there. They have, you know, different political philosophies, and they have different eschatology, and you know, all that stuff is sort of varied even within the people who self-identify as Christian nationalists. And then there are other people who are just thinking the issue through. You know, there are things that they hear that sound good to them, and there are things that they hear that don't sound so great to them, and they're trying to figure all this stuff out. I think one of the reasons why this has become such a topic, and by the way, it is I would say not a new topic. It is a renewed topic. It is not something that as we'll see when we get into it, it has been a practice of Christians for a long time to think about what they call political theology. But it's renewed now probably because people are losing confidence in our political system at a massive scale, at a real level. I mean, people have always sort of joked about, I think, politicians and you know, unreliability of government, and you know, we've always sort of we've grown up with that stuff, but this is at a different scale. And when you're losing confidence in the political system, and let me elaborate on that. I mean, there are people who are losing confidence in the system and in the people. Like the people, people used to believe that they had a combative system, but there was a group that they could identify with that was going to champion their cause within that system. And if you could get a few more of those people in place, you know, maybe you could get some progress. But I think nowadays people are beginning to wonder, is anybody out there really championing the cause of the common man? Everybody, you know, we refer to the swamp of D.C. I mean, is everybody polluted? You know, whenever they go up there, there certainly are times when you could almost seem to make the case, and people give testimony about that. That's not anything new. It's probably just becoming more publicized because of social media and, you know, more democratic access to information. It's been there for a long time. I remember talking to a guy in our church that was a staffer with Newt Gingrich all the way back when. And I asked him, it's like, why didn't you not continue your political career there? And he said, it is a cesspool. Like, Washington is a cesspool. I mean, he as a Christian knew that he could not spend very much time there without just completely losing his soul. So it's been going on for a long time, but people are more aware of it now because of, you know, carrying around devices in our pocket that we can document everything. But now the, you know, now because of all that, we're wondering whether or not the system itself is redeemable. Like, is it even possible? You know, it's not, it might be possible to get one or two good people, but is it possible within the system that we have to actually have any hope for the future? I mean, that's kind of the despair that you sometimes feel whenever you're reading about politics in general. And then I think, you know, to sort of take that a little bit further, as Christians, I think the one thing that everyone agrees on, no matter whether they identify as a Christian nationalist or not identify as a Christian nationalist, I think the one thing that almost everybody agrees on is that secularism has failed. Like, secularism is not the answer. Whatever the answer is, it seems that the more and more secularism takes over the culture, the more and more irrational and more ridiculous it gets. You know, you got, you know, women's sports now being taken over by men. You know, you've got people who are being persecuted for saying the most reasonable things about free speech. I mean, you've got this kind of stuff, and you're like, whoa. I mean, these things are getting at the very core of who we are and what we thought we were as a nation. And I think for many years, Christians acknowledged that secular culture was surviving on Christian capital. Like, we had paid in, not we personally, but the Christian church had paid in all of this work through the years to build a kind of general consciousness in Western civilization, Judeo-Christian civilization, and in society, and even in particularly in America. It paid in a certain amount of moral consciousness that shows up in our founding documents and all of that. And then even as people who are in government places were not believing that, it, you know, or were not expressly wanting to defend that anymore, they were still running on the rails that have been laid by that kind of morality, and to some extent enjoying the structure of a society that was built on a transcendence, an idea of transcendence, something that goes beyond human realm. And that's kind of where we have enjoyed, but we feel like now things are going off the rails. Like, that capital has been spent and no one is making any more deposits there. And so we're at the end of the line. That's the way people are beginning to feel. And, you know, some Christians believe that there is no future then, at least in our current form. There has always been a deference, it would seem, in American culture to what's known as classical liberalism, not modern day secular liberalism or what we might call progressive liberalism, but classic liberalism, which is a basic idea that all ideas are given neutral space. They're equally entertained in the marketplace of ideas to make their case. And so this is really where the Christian realm, the Christian world, has staked its claim, particularly within Protestantism. That's not so much a part of Catholicism, but within the Protestant culture, well, a distinctly Protestant thing has been the defense of the freedom of thought, because Protestants came out of the oppression of thought. Protestants generally came out of a world where there was no freedom of thought and there was no freedom of speech. Within the world of Catholic dogma and Catholic Christendom, you know, you were at best exiled. At worst, you were burned if you were under that. And of course, you know, we all hear stories about the Inquisition and how terrible that was. So whenever Protestants came out of that, one of the things that was really big for them was to give the freedom
of religion,
the freedom to choose your own faith. And so, our heritage was generally labeled as dissidents or nonconformist. That's kind of what the heritage was of our constitutional, democracy idea. So that's kind of where Christians set their boundaries within what they considered to be classic liberalism. But as classic liberalism has been taken over more and more by progressive liberalism and by secular liberalism, people now are beginning to ask the question whether it's possible to have a neutral world. Like, can you actually have true classic liberalism where all ideas are given equal space and given the freedom to make their case, and the best ideas are going to win out? Because people are beginning to realize that the other side doesn't seem so neutral. Like, the secular side is not embracing the kind of neutrality that early Christian thinkers may have embraced. And they're suggesting that there's no such thing as neutrality. Now, whenever you delve into this world of political theology, you're going to inevitably encounter and have to, go through this discussion, the idea of neutrality. And this is a phrase that you'll hear a lot from Christian nationalists. There's no neutrality. You either choose the side of secularism or you choose the side of Christianity. That's just the bottom line. And if you choose the side of Christianity, you are a Christian nationalist. That's the way that they want to reduce the argument down. And it resonates with a lot of people because they're looking out at the world around them and they're like, yeah, these secularists are actually suppressing free speech. The secularists are actually not wanting their ideas exposed. I mean, we hear yesterday, the January 6th committee erases all these emails days before they hand over to the Republicans, and you're like, what in the world is going on? Who is allowed to do that kind of stuff without going to jail? And you just think there's no way that these people are ever going to vouch for free speech or whatever it might be. And then, you want to hope that maybe the other side of the political spectrum is going to be better, but you realize that they're not even always transparent. Many times they're not. They're sometimes suppressing speech that they don't like. And if it agrees with you, wonderful. But if it doesn't agree with you, it might cut against you. So, this whole idea of neutrality evokes discussions then of whether or not we can continue to buy into an idea of a neutral kind of government, a neutral kind of political system, a classic liberalism. You are going to have to eventually choose your side. And so this, by the way, if you are at all familiar with this, these are ideas that have been coming out of a guy named Aaron Wren for a long time. He's been trying to make this argument for a long time, but only recently have people really started to sort of listen to that. And so a lot of people were asking themselves, yeah, am I for neutrality? Or am I really for a Christian nation? And if I'm for a Christian nation, then am I a Christian nationalist? And what does all of that mean? Because as I said, the one thing that we all sort of agree is that secularism doesn't work. Or another way to say that is it possible for a nation to govern a nation with no reference to the transcendent? Is it possible to govern a nation, that doesn't have any reference point for its morality outside of itself? And what is that ultimately going to mean? And if you conclude that it's not possible to govern a nation without reference to the transcendent, or if you agree that it's not possible to govern a nation with a self-defined morality, or morality that arises from the individual themselves, then are you going to just accept the fact that a nation is ungovernable? I mean, is that your only place to go? So Christians feel conflicted in all of this, and it leads them to discussions, philosophical discussions, theological discussions about civil government. Andy Nasselli recounts a conversation that I read over the holidays that I thought was insightful, where he said, he was hearing this from somebody else, but he was relaying the conversation, where a Muslim man said to a Christian, "I find no guidance in the Quran on how Muslims should live as a minority in a society, and no guidance in the New Testament on how Christians should live as a majority." In other words, and he's just kind of saying from a theological perspective, the Quran assumes a political philosophy of dominance. Like, it assumes that you're going to have a nation that has a caliphate of some sort that governs everything top down so that everybody has to conform. Even if you have some tolerance for minority faiths, they're very monitored. Whereas he's saying, this guy was saying, from the New Testament perspective, that doesn't seem to be the case at all. You know, maybe you can make an argument different from the Old Testament. From the New Testament perspective, there doesn't seem to be any discussion about political philosophy in the whole. And so this is a central issue that Christians have tried to grapple with. And there have been a lot of people who have thought about it through the years. But most of them are very old. You know, most of them go back to what we generally refer to as the magisterial Reformation. That is to say, these were people who were the first generation after Catholic-dominated societies. They were introducing a form of Protestantism within a world that still understood that the church was governed by the government. And so they, in some ways, slipped into those shoes, but in a Protestant way. But they were trying to think through, how are we different than Catholics? I mean, we were once the oppressed, now we're in control, now we are the majority, but how do we think that through as Protestants? And so a lot of the writing that initially informs this has not been recent. It is 200-300 years old, and people are reawakening to some extent into those debates and beginning to ask questions about how radical of a change do we really need. I mean, do we just need a new president? Do we just need a few more of our, you know, political party in seats of power? Or do we need something really radical, like really going back into time and changing things in a big way? And of course, there are a lot of people who, on the other side of the spectrum, don't even think about this stuff. I mean, they even wonder, is this even necessary? Is it even profitable? I mean, is it an area that Christians should even be thinking about? Because we can write books about it, we can theorize about it, but let's be honest, it's never going to happen, right? I mean, we can write books about how wonderful it would be to have a Christian nation, Christian king, Christian constitution, whatever it might be. I mean, yeah, it's like drawing a picture on the wall. I mean, it's very, very pretty, but it's never going to happen. So why even bother thinking about it? Why even try to articulate all that stuff? So, those people don't see much value in the whole discussion, and really have kind of ignored the discussion, or have even been offended by the discussion. And in some ways, you know, they kind of join in with the warnings of where those kind of discussions could go. They generally kind of say, well, you know, if you get what you want, how are you going to ensure that your form of Christian nationalism, or the form of Christian nationalism, is your form? Like, how can you guarantee that that thing doesn't go in a direction that's actually going to turn against you, and is going to wind up leaving you persecuted, but persecuted by people who are now doing it not in the name of secularism, but in the name of some Christian faith? It could very well be that, just illustration's sake, could very well be that Anglicanism becomes the accepted form, or that even Presbyterianism becomes the accepted form, or some sort of ecumenical Christianity becomes the accepted form. I mean, how comfortable are you with sort of a top-down governing style if you want to go back to a magisterial form? You know, some guys like Doug Wilson push back against that. They would say, well, you know, that's all coming from secularism. Secularism tells you that if you have a Christian nation, that we're going to herd up all the women and dress them in red, you know, in red coats and ship them off to breeding farms. And, you know, you're going to have that kind of intolerance, and, you know, people that are outside of your realm are going to be treated humanely. But Doug Wilson would say, well, that's just secularism's warnings. Why are you going to believe their warnings? You know, you don't believe their promises. Why would you believe their warnings? So he would make that argument. But we got to ask, you know, is that really an argument that holds up in history? You know, how has this idea of magisterial government, magisterial reformation, how has that worked in the past? And has it worked well? And I think as you press and press into the issue, you wind up sometimes getting very uncomfortable answers. In fact, guys like Doug Wilson, you know, he actually calls for a reestablishment of what he calls Christendom. His book on this, I think, is called, is it The New Christendom? Does anyone know the title? It's got Christendom in the name.
Mere
Christendom, that's right. But it's not the old Christendom. It's a Christendom 2.0, I think is what he calls it. So he recognizes that it hasn't worked well in the past, and there would have to be some things that would be fundamentally different. Those are uncomfortable questions. And then there is the sort of the whole idea that is the sort of the fly in the ointment a lot of times of not where we need to go, but how do we believe things will end? Like, the idea of eschatology plays a major, major factor in this. This is something that I think Christian nationalists want to diminish. They actually, I think, make efforts not to bring scrutiny to this area, because they, I think, inherently understand that on a level playing field, their ideas of eschatology have not prevailed on the broader Christian realm. The dominant view, probably in America, in America is probably either amillennialism or something called historic premillennialism. But neither of those marry very well with Christian nationalism. The dominant view in Europe has been amillennialism. And again, it doesn't marry very, very well with Christian nationalism. So if you're going to embrace a Christian nationalism or Christian national scheme, it's going to have some sort of concept of an establishment of an earthly kingdom, which is going to push you pretty much in a post-millennial route. Now, we'll have a chance to debate that and to talk about that in the coming weeks as we get into this a little bit more. But I think, you know, when we get into the scripture, we're going to, I believe, be able to validate that. Now, what I wanted to do today, this is really introduction, okay? This is just kind of broad parameters. Today is more about definition than examination. I just want to kind of take some time to give the broadest boundaries of this discussion, and then in the coming weeks, kind of continue to narrow that in. Part of that is because I'm honestly still reading and understanding all this stuff, and so that's the way I think. I mean, I begin kind of making the outside boundaries and kind of working my way in, and so that's just where I am or where I have been in my own reading. So in some ways, I'm just bringing you along with my own journeys. I've known about Christian nationalism. I've thought about it, as I said, in a very general way for a number of years. But I've kind of always had a political theology that was well intact, and so I didn't feel necessarily deeply drawn into these discussions. But because of where things have gone since the pandemic, and where people are going in their own political philosophies in recent years, and the acceleration and heightening of these discussions, I felt like it was definitely worth our time to take a much deeper dive into these kinds of things. So that's what I want to do today, is just kind of talk in very broad terms about what you might call political theology, and give you the landscape to some extent. And you can't really talk about political theology without talking about what some people just generally refer to as Christ in culture, like philosophy of Christ in culture. There's a helpful blog post by Kevin DeYoung, who is one of the leading voices in this discussion, pushing back against Christian nationalism. But in this in a series of blog posts he actually outlines what have been accepted as four categories of Christ and culture, and then names some of the what he considers to be the adherents of this. The first one would be Christianity against politics. Christianity against politics, which he says, this is the view that Christianity is largely something that stands opposed to the messy and often idolatrous world of politics. This approach warns Christians about putting hope in earthly kings or earthly kingdoms. It's often uninterested in the intellectual contours of political science or the long history of moral philosophy, and it can be unrealistic about how political and social change happens. It generally is a very much sort of non-compromise, my way or the highway approach. And he would put sort of at the forefront of this, John Piper, as one of the chief adherents, proponents of this Christianity against politics. You might think of some other people that you would put in that category. I was reading I'm reading the biography of Martin Lloyd-Jones right now. It's sad that I've like only started reading Lloyd-Jones' biography. I'm 51 years old. Should have read it 20 years ago, but it's been on the shelf just staring at me. It's got a picture of Lloyd-Jones on the spine, and he looks at me every time I find my office. So finally I gave in, and I've been reading. It's excellent. It's really good. But he would be in this category. I mean, he kind of talks about growing up and being a hero worshiper of Lloyd George and other British politicians. And then whenever he came to faith and then eventually entered in the ministry, he renounced all that stuff. You know, he was very much Christianity. It stays out of all that mess and quest. So that would be one view of Christ and culture. The second view would be Christianity above politics. So this teaches that Christianity is the truth that transcends all worldly systems. It understands Christianity is not identified with any particular political philosophy, any particular political party or intellectual tradition. So on the negative side, it critiques, its critiques are sometimes creating moral equivalents, like it's always sort of wanting to be above the fray, and can come across as making it sound like that secularism and Christianity both commit same ills, or at least Christians and secularists are guilty of the same things all the time. And so there becomes sort of a moral equivalency, and it's always seeming to work towards a sort of an imaginary midpoint somewhere between Marxism and capitalism. Like there's some happy medium that if we could just get to it, everybody would be happy. And he puts in this category, and I think this is certainly accurate, Tim Keller. Like if you have read much of Tim Keller or the Gospel Coalition, this is what you've read. Like we let you, like just renounce everything. Everybody's got problems on all sides. Let's just kind of find the happy middle. That's Christianity above politics. And then he has a third category, Christianity as politics, where he says the message of Christianity and the task of the individual Christian is seen as irreducibly political. Like we cannot separate our evangelistic efforts and our political efforts because they are so intricately interwoven. And this one would be, he would say, Doug Wilson. This is his position, who is a major proponent of Christian nationalism. Like you cannot legitimately think about changing individuals with the gospel without also imagining a change of culture that comes with it. And they're one and the same. And then he says there's a fourth view, Christianity undergirds politics. This is where he says Christian ideas and Christian communities are essential to a healthy political order. Even if they're not in the majority, their ideas must be a robust part of the national conversation. And so this looks at a heritage of development in the Christian, in the Western culture that goes back to fundamentally Christian ideals that have established notions of freedom of conscience, of freedom of thought, and it comes with a political philosophy as well as a moral philosophy, you know, that you can't fully extricate from one another. And this, he actually names Hillsdale College. Some of you guys are familiar with Hillsdale College, and you know some of their conservative thought. You could put some other groups in there. So those are four broad categories of how you think about Christ and culture. Those actually come from a guy named Richard Niebuhr, his little book on Christ and culture, which is very dry. It's a very dry read, but it is looked at by many people as being sort of the singular work on that particular topic. I appreciate D. Young putting it in a very digestible form, because I read about half of Niebuhr and my eyes were rolling back in my head. Anyway, that might help you a little bit to think about where your mind has been, where your heart has been, maybe on that spectrum. And then taking that, I want to just kind of really quickly run through seven views of government and religion. This is not culture so much as it is government. Let me take a sip of coffee. Seven views. This actually comes from Andy Nicelli. Seven views of government and religion. I'm taking them in different order than what Nicelli gave them, but I'm going to use his categories because, again, I think they're very helpful. The first one is government over religion. That is to say, government governs and enforces religion. There is most definitely a state religion, a state-endorsed religion, whether it is a state church or a state religion. And, this has obviously a very long, ancient history. In fact, this would have been the dominant view in the ancient world, whether it was Egypt or even the Roman emperor who demanded worship of himself, or you know, whatever it might be. In the modern world, you do have examples of this primarily in the Muslim world. This is their view. Government over religion. Like, they believe that the government has a responsibility, has a role given to it by God to establish the Muslim faith. And one of the their primary means of spreading the Muslim faith is by spreading their political philosophy, Sharia law. I mean, you've got to go wherever you can and establish Sharia law. And this is why it makes it very difficult for a true Muslim to in any way embrace classical liberalism or the Western mentality. They're like oil and water. They just don't mesh together, because for them, they generally do not, they don't invest a lot in trying to win people over in the marketplace of ideas. You know, they don't have a true apologetic field like Christianity does. They just have a political field. And you go and you make war and you overtake by your power until eventually you can bring everyone in submission to Islam. So that would be one view. Another view is the religion over government view. Religion governs the government and directs government to enforce religion, but always under the guidance of religion. Now, this is the traditional Catholic view. The Catholic view always had this tug of war with the king, always this battle over, you know, who is going to do what. You read history on this, and there's massive sort of focus on the actual coronations of the Holy Roman Emperor. You understand that there were kings and there were sort of territorial rulers within Europe for a long time, until such a point as the Catholic Church decided to crown one of these emperors as the Holy Roman Emperor. And this was a big deal whenever they did this, having the Pope actually place the crown on the head of the king as the Holy Roman Emperor, not the king of his little empire, but the king of all of Christendom. And then he was entrusted, he was the one who was given the primary duty of ensuring the Christian faith throughout the entire world. And this was part of what led to the Crusades. You know, the idea that a particular king, I think it was King Louis at that point, who led the First Crusade, if I'm not mistaken, but he was the one who felt it was his duty, because it had been granted to him by the church, a mandate by the church, to go and to make sure that the Christian religion is seen everywhere. But there's always this tension, because the Catholic Church wanted to claim its authority over the Holy Roman Emperor, but they were always in battle with one another. I mean, the emperors resented the idea that some pope in the Vatican would have actually more authority than they do. And in some cases, there was bloodshed and intrigue and bribery to get, you know, their guy in place there in the Vatican. Now, this view, since it's not Muslim, since it is primarily Christian and Catholic, it's pretty much still the Catholic view. It's obviously not being enacted almost anywhere today, anywhere that I can really think of at all. But there are a few people who are pushing for it. This is probably where Rush Dooney, if you guys know Rusus Rush Dooney, he's probably in this realm where he just thinks that the church should be the one who's appointing all the Christian leaders out there. It's a very extreme form of, I'm forgetting the word right now, not just post-millennialism, but
dominionism,
not even dominionism. There's another term. Probably reconstructionism is what I'm thinking of. But anyway, that would be that particular view. Number three, secular suppression. Got to put that on the map as well, where the secular government suppresses religion. Religion shouldn't be tolerated because it undermines what is in the best interest of all the people. And so therefore, you know, religion has always been in some ways, an oppression of thought, an oppression of classes or whatever it might be. And so you suppress it. And this is obviously communism, Marxism. You see it today, obviously, in places like North Korea, in, you know, more or less in China, even though they have some established church religion. There definitely is a lot of suppression of religion. So that would be different than the view of the Islamic world, but would also not be friendly to Christianity. And then you get into really what are four views, I think, that are more in the spectrum of Protestantism. One of them, we might say view number four, is religious separation. That is to say, religion must radically separate from the government, should be totally distinct spheres, not overlapping at all. Individuals separate from the government and don't participate. They don't wield the sword. They're never given the sword. And magistrates are given the sword, but we don't cooperate with that because to do so would be putting us in conflict with our gospel mandate. And this is probably where the historic Anabaptist would have been placed. They were pacifist in most cases, like you don't even join the army. You don't get involved with any of that stuff at all. And in modern day, you know, there are modern day Mennonites and those kinds of Quakers that might, you know, be extreme pacifists today and take that kind of a view. Greg Boyd is one of the guys, if you know that name, who, you know, basically a liberal Christian, has a very deficient view of God, but that would be his particular view as well. He's a pacifist. View number five is religious neutrality. The government must be religiously neutral. So whereas the previous view was, you know, Christians were saying stay away from the government, this view basically is the government saying stay away from religion. Like, just keep your hands out of religion altogether. This is probably what most people think of whenever they think of the separation of church and state. That's not an accurate definition of it, but I think this is the popular definition of it. But this is probably where John Locke and John Stuart Mill were whenever they were writing their political philosophy that became so much of the founding of our own nation, that the government should separate, in a sense, from all religious discussions. It should be always religiously neutral. It should respect all thought equally and encourage a pluralistic society. So there's just absolutely this wall between government and the endorsement or support of any religious particular system. Now we know that actually cuts both ways. It can provide a level of freedom, but if there's ever a sense that your freedom is encroaching on someone else's freedom, you actually become the target in that. And so that view, while it might sound nice at first, doesn't play out always very well in favor of Christians. View number six is religious influence. The government should not promote only one particular religion, but religion may influence the government within limited parameters. That is to say, the church and the government are separate. They have distinct authorized jurisdictions, and yet there should be a sense of transcendence among our politicians that they themselves are not the ultimate source of morality. Or another way to say this is that the government recognizes that there is a transcendent morality outside of itself to which it must appeal. And that transcendent morality, at least in our Western civilization, is our Judeo-Christian heritage. And so there's always an openness to some agreed upon Judeo-Christian morality in its broadest sense. And, basically celebrate that. Now, there would be a lot of people who would fall into this camp. Wayne Grudem would be in this camp. Andrew Walker would be in this camp. John Piper would actually probably put himself in this camp. One name that I think is a really good thinker in this, one of my favorite writers in this, is a guy named David Van Drunen. If you're wanting to read up on political theology or political philosophy, I highly recommend Van Drunen. But he would be in that camp too, where you just kind of have a constant reinforcement of morality within the government. And then there's a final group, Christian government. The government and the Christian overlap. That we are two God-ordained institutions that have distinct and overlapping jurisdictions, and we should work together under God's ultimate authority. The church's mission is distinct. Like, they need to stay focused on making disciples of all nations, but the government is in support of that mission and does what it can to facilitate that mission, and it promotes that because it understands that its authority is also given by God, and so it constantly acknowledges that. Now, this would be where probably the magisterial, you know, all those old guys, John Knox, Ulrich Zwingli, John Calvin, and even, you know, sort of getting into the American experiment, most of the Puritans would probably have had some form of this. It's interesting. I was listening to a podcast over the holidays talking about how much focus we put on the U.S. Constitution and whether or not there's explicit separation of church and states. But the guy I was listening to was making the point that among the 13 founding colonies, there was no separation of church and state. Many of the founding constitutions of the states were explicitly religious, very explicitly authorizing some sort of Christian prayer or, you know, things like that. So, you know, he's just making the case that the founding Puritans, who a lot of times were the governing leaders in at least the New England states, had this view of religion and government working together. And this is obviously where Doug Wilson who's the guy that wrote the book on Christian nationalism? Stephen Wolf, yes. I'm sorry, too early. Stephen Wolf and those guys would probably be certainly in this category, as well as Abraham Kuyper. You hear that sometimes, Kuyperism, William Bradford, William Penn, all those sort of founding fathers. Even Jonathan Edwards would be in that same kind of boat. So those are the seven views. I don't know. Can you guys think of any other category that doesn't fit within those seven? No, I pretty much covered you, doesn't it? So it just lets you know that people have been thinking about this for a long time and then kind of mapping out where they stand in a long time. And as you hear it that laid out in that way, you can probably think through that and think, yeah, that might work. That might have problems. But that's what we want to do in the coming weeks. I want to kind of take those broad parameters now. And next week, what we're going to do is we're going to actually dive into some quotes from Stephen Wolf and from Doug Wilson, the two big names probably in this realm, and try to distinguish their views of Christian nationalism and what they're getting at. And maybe if we can next week, get into implications of what they're actually saying we should be doing. And then after that, we're going to then turn our focus really into the scripture
and ask ourselves questions about all this stuff that we've been defining this week and maybe next week.
Before we close out, do y'all have any questions, any comments on just this kind of broad
foundry stuff? I'm sorry to drag you on my journey as I walk through this stuff. Yes. Is it being applied globally or just within the U.S.? Are they thinking of
Stephen Wolf, I think, is pretty explicit. He's just talking about America. Doug Wilson is explicit, saying, you know, I'm talking about like at least a League of Nations, if not, you know, kind of a general philosophy that can be applied to any country in the world. So there is some distinction in the way that these guys are even thinking about it. But the seven parameters are obviously trying to think every nation in the world. How are they governed? And what do the various governments look like? And what are their assumptions about religion? Other questions?